The following program is being broadcast on the Amazing Women of Power, the world's leading positive programming network, powered by Raven International. This show contains motivational language and may not be suitable for negative listeners.
My dreams. I've had enough of these annoying and distracting schemes. I'll choose my friends because apparently they're choosing me. The time is now to pay attention to my destiny.
From his humble studio in Orange County, California, comes a young songwriter with a dream, encouraging others to go after their dreams. Learning from the best in the business and passing it along to you, it's Strong Rider on the radio.
I had the blues, but I made it better, baby. And that's why I wrote this song. And now you can sing along.
My mind's made up to celebrate and learn from, by keeping my ears open, a wonderful, legendary songwriter. I'm going to tell you who that is in just a second. Let me introduce myself. My name is Dean Olson, and I am the Strong Rider on the radio, helping songwriters and artists to stay musically fit. And the way I like to do that is through faith and encouragement, by learning from the best in the business and passing it along to you. When I say the best in the business, I think you're going to agree that my next guest fits that description to the letter of the law, whatever that law might be. He is Richard M. Sherman. If that name sounds familiar, then you are in for a wonderful hour of stories and advice from the man who created, with his brother, thousands of songs for many of the Disney films that appeared in the 60s and early 70s. I'd be here for about 5 or 10 minutes just reading off the list of many songs that they worked on, but just to give you an idea, they wrote the songs for The Parent Trap, The Sword and the Stone, Mary Poppins, The Jungle Book, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Winnie the Pooh, the list goes on, The Happiest Millionaire, and then some other non-Disney films were Snoopy Come Home, Charlotte's Web, and one of my favorites, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Oh, man. The list goes on and on, but why keep talking about him when I have him right here through the magic of this thing we call the telephone? It's a true pleasure to introduce you to my new friend, Richard Sherman. What a treat. Richard, how are you, sir? How's your day going?
Great. Thank you. It's great to be talking to you, and I'm feeling fit as a fiddle.
Good. Fit as a fiddle for your age and your young man. What did you turn this last month?
I just turned 87.
That's wonderful.
But I don't feel it. I really don't feel my age at all. I'm very sort of having fun, having a good time with my life, and I just sort of don't think about myself as an old geezer. I'm just a young guy having a good time.
Well, I didn't call you an old geezer, but I'll tell you what, that when I see you... You know, the YouTube is kind of nice to have because we can see a lot of the events you go to now when you do a live performance or a show. And you're always so upbeat and positive. And like, for instance, you went to the El Capitan not too long ago.
That's right.
And they just adore you. Probably because the songs that you wrote precede your reputation. And they'll
Well, you know, it's just a fun thing. I've had the good fortune of being a songwriter for, among other wonderful producers, perhaps the greatest producer of the last century, and that's Walt Disney.
Yeah.
And Walt Disney gave my brother Bob and myself the opportunity to write songs for some of his greatest projects, I mean, in the 60s and early 70s. And so, basically, Bob and I sort of were launched by the Disney Company, and I'm still involved with Disney. I still write things for them. We'll talk about that. But basically, sure. I'm a very lucky guy because I've done my career has been my fun thing. I never consider it work. I've always had a good time with it.
And you've two of the most famous collaborators were your brother, Robert, and Milt Larson.
Oh, Milt is my best friend, and he's a terrific guy, and he's an entrepreneur. He has his fingers in just about everything, but he created that incredible place called the Magic Castle.
Yes.
And he and I have been writing fun songs together for years, and we did a full-scale musical, a couple of them actually, over the years, and we also did a series of hilarious, I consider, fun things called Smash Flops. songs that could have been hits except for terrible timing. And that's it's a whole sense of humor kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Stumbled on that many years ago, and we've been doing it ever since.
So, yeah, safe to say that these songs that you wrote with them are written with tongue firmly in cheek. Yeah?
Oh, my God, yes, of course. How would you write a song called Bon Voyage Titanic thinking seriously that you were trying
to... Or the Confederate victory song, or even Congratulations, Tom Dewey.
Exactly. This, we stumbled upon this one day. Milt's an avid record collector. He has an incredible collection of recordings.
Wow.
And that's how I met him, in an old record store. And we became very fast friends. We've been friends for over 60 years now. And one day he played me a record of a song my father wrote, which had become a smash hit back in 1927. It was called Lindbergh, Eagle of the USA, and it was a commemorative song that Lindbergh had flown the Atlantic all on his own and landed safely, and they published it. And I said to Milt, when he was playing this record for me, I said, you know, that song never would have been published if Lindy took a dip into the drink, you know, if he'd gone into the ocean. It would have never been published. And he said, Well, I said it would have been, no, it was a smash hit. And he said, yes, it would have been a smash flop. We both started laughing. I said, my God, what a funny idea. And we both started laughing at that and said, what if somebody had written a commemorative song about the Hindenburg landing in New Jersey?
Right.
You know, and just as the band is about to play the song, the bloody thing explodes. You know, I mean, wow. You know, we were falling on the floor. I mean, it's terrible. It's morbid, but it's also very funny.
Yeah, that's the thing I was thinking about, the morbidity, or even people saying, hey, listen, I take offense to that song. You know?
I know. Well, you can't help but be funny and offend somebody. I figure you have to have a tongue-in-cheek attitude about life. If you can't laugh at some of the terrible things, naturally you wait a long, long time before you do a thing like this. It was many years after the Hindenburg that we wrote about it, and we wrote supposedly that somebody had written a tribute to the landing, the happy landing of the airship, of the air dirigible.
Yeah.
And basically, there was innocence involved in it. And then, of course, it exploded. We said that song never got published. It just went up in flames.
Oh, geez. So what's the Smash Flops? What's the history of this album? You must have, this is an old thing. You wrote it back when you first two met, I guess, huh?
Well, the original recordings of Smash Flops, they're no longer exist. But subsequent to the original Smash Flops, we re-recorded a lot of these songs, added lyrics and polished the songs, and they issued them on various albums for commemorative occasions. For example, on the anniversary of the centennial, the bicentennial, we did a thing called Smash Flops the centennial Smash Flops or something. We had a different thing, and we added numbers for that, and we polished some of the songs. And this is the selection of the 16 songs, but one has two versions of it. But 17 songs that actually were the cream of many, many, many issues of the Smash Flops, along with two brand new songs that we just wrote because we had to write some brand new things that are funny and also to have a little hook for our album. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote a song to diehard Palin people
who wanted to have
Sarah Palin as president. They wrote a song called Palin for President Polka, and they want her to run in 2016.
Let's do the Palin for President Polka. Sarah Palin, Sarah Palin, though your campaign train's derailing and the party bills you gave us quite a scare. Though they laughed at ya and panned ya, and they still don't understand ya.
You'll be winning in the end, so we don't care.
Just keep an eye on those Russians and shoot another moose or caribou. And deny all discussion. Sarah, we're with you. This is the Palin for President Polka. Let's do the Palin for President Polka.
But I can't see Russia from my house.
And we wrote a song commemorating the fracking of the country, you know, where they blow up the crust of the earth to look for oil.
Exactly.
And so we had a pro-fracking song, because many people don't want these things happening.
Yeah.
And so he decided it's controversial, we'll write about it.
What would become of the automobile if we gave up gasoline? Look what became of the steamer when Stanley ran out of steam. You can't go too far in an electric car if your battery dies, alas. So let's make nice to those sheiks and kiss them on both cheeks while we overpay for their gas.
Let us pray for petroleum. Let's keep fracking away. Soil, grab the oil, so we can make our gas the oil American way.
So we just took the opposite side of things and wrote and laughed ourselves silly writing them. And so we had a very good time. And when we finished, we digitally remastered all of the best that we've found of the recordings of the past years and put them all together in one compendium. And we also put them in the year that supposedly they had been written. Of course, it's all malarkey. I mean, we wrote them all.
Right. In other words, you wrote the George Washington song by...
Yeah, of course, we wrote George Washington. We wrote a song laughing at Christopher Columbus, you know?
Yeah.
With Christopher Columbus, you big bag of steam. We had all these songs supposedly written back in 1492. Of course, it's not written then. But the fun of it all was the fact that we had a good time. And you know, there's a thing called a busman's holiday. And so this was our busman's holiday. Milton is a very serious producer of wonderful, wonderful projects, and I am a serious songwriter, basically. But together we have a good time writing funny songs, and that's what we did.
I'm going to get to speak with Milt tomorrow after we talk. And we'll talk about you behind your back, but I hope it will be kind to you, I'm sure.
Oh. Try to be kind. You know, we are very fast friends. We've been friends forever, and we've always had wonderful times together. And we inspire each other to laugh a lot and to share our humor. And when we come up with a concept, and the whole thing in the secret to a good song is the concept. It isn't the words and it isn't the music. It's the concept behind it. If you're a good writer, good, you can write a good song. But if you write a song with a funny concept or a clever concept or something that's different, that makes it a better song. And that makes it something that people want to hear, that you can reissue. And so basically, these songs all have funny concepts to them. They really, truly do.
Yeah, they're cute. Why did you choose to go with that sort of John Philip Sousa style approach with a lot of the songs, you know, the marching band? And
I like John Philip Sousa, and actually in those years when these songs supposedly were written, that would be the style of song to be written. And so we wrote, if it's a happy little waltz, we wrote a waltz. If it was a march, we wrote a march. But it would just, we choose what we felt was right. And if it's a folky kind of a song, we're done with a plucked banjo or a guitar, we write it that way. You know, we had the Confederate victory song was written with a guitar. You know, everything had its own style.
Did was Milt responsible for producing the whole project?
The original recordings were all produced by Milt, and now I'm producing with him. I'm doing some of it, but basically, the original concepts and all we wrote them for originally the first Smash Flops were written for a group called the Characters. And they did the first album.
Uh-huh.
And that was, you know, Monoro, and it was just a piano and a bass and guitar. You know, it was a very simple recording. Now we've added orchestra and we've added, you know, all kinds of good stuff to it to give it a fuller sound and a more comprehensive group. And then we also have girls singing and fellas singing. So it's not just a bunch of four guys singing songs.
Yeah.
And it's they all developed from the original, but they all have the same fun and spirit that the very first original ones did.
Yeah, you have to. You got to keep with that theme if you're going to do a... It's almost one of those, like when you reissue or you do a greatest hits, you always throw a couple more in because the...
That's exactly right. You got to keep it fresh and exciting. And here's the thing. Remember, the original versions of these were some 50 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of the people that buy records today were not even a blink in their father's eye at the time. They were not born. They were long before they were born. So if they're still funny today, there must be something special about the concept. And that's what we felt was good, because every once in a while when I'm doing a PR thing or my personal appearance. I'll play them as a like an encore at the end of the of my performance. And the people fall apart. You know, I mean, youngsters, they're just screaming when I start playing When Amelia Earhart Flies Home. I mean, something like that.
Yeah.
They go crazy. And so I think it's kind of fun to just remember that we have youngsters who have never heard these things. And so they're hearing them now all beautifully remastered, digitally remastered, and they sound very clean and good, and they all sound very bright, like they recorded yesterday. And of course, two of the songs are brand new, so that makes it contemporary.
Yeah, and they sort of fit with the same motif. It almost sounds like you could have, you know, even though they're updated and everything, they do sound, they have the same feel to it, so that's good.
Basic madness in all of them.
Basic madness, yeah. And also, besides Smash Flops, you two are also working still on Pizzazz. I thought that was kind of...
Pizzazz is a wonderful show. We really poured ourselves into that. It's a fun show. It has a lot of fun, and it's the story of early Broadway, when Broadway was at the turn of the last century, when young George M. Cohan came to work for two humorous guys named Weber and Fields. And he learned a lot about show business and about dealing with people from his experience with them back in the turn of the last century.
Right.
And it's a true story, basically. It's based on true happenings, that there was a syndicate that controlled Broadway, and the Weber and Fields people tried to fight that and have independent productions of their own that weren't controlled by this group. And we changed the names to protect the guilty. So we call it the syndicate. We just refer to them as the syndicate. And Skimmer and Khan, we call the names.
Oh, I see.
They're just made up names, but that's what we made. And it's a fun show. It really is. It has a lot of period music in it that feels good, and it's singable and fun. And we poured ourselves into it. It's been twice produced and very, very well.
Oh.
And we're hoping to get a major producer to come in and take over and do it in big time. We did it up in Santa Barbara at the Barbero Theater, and then we did it before that in another theater, and it was very well received. So we hope that we'll have it launched one of these days. It's a dream of ours.
Excellent. So will we see a different side of Cohan than the portrayal that Jimmy Cagney gave us in the movie?
Well, you'll see a very brash young guy who's learning a lot of the ropes. It's before the Cagney Cohan that you know. It's when he was a young kid that used to get fired because he always knew too much, and he would always tell people off and shout his mouth off. And his father said, "You're going to learn a little bit of the discipline of theater. I have two guys that are going to teach you something." And he sent him and his older sister, Josie, to New York to work for Weber and Fields at the Weber and Fields Music Hall. And he learned a lot of things about life and about how to handle people from those two guys. And it sort of set a pattern for his life. And he also became his own entrepreneur and his own producer and everything because of Weber and Fields. People don't know anything about that. It's before it was called the Great White Way, when it was little old Broadway.
Right.
And it was just little old Broadway where they had this tiny little hole-in-the-wall theater, and they used to produce hilarious stuff and fought the syndicate. And it's a great story. It really is.
This whole vaudeville era, were you inspired a lot when you started out writing songs by that type of music?
Well, you got to remember, I come from a long line of songwriters. My father was a wonderful songwriter. He wrote many big hits for Eddie Cantor and Jolson, and he wrote songs for Bing Crosby. Oh, no, Bob, my dad, Al Sherman, was a great writer. He wrote You Gotta Be a Football Hero. It's a standard today.
Oh,
you
he
gotta
wrote that.
Be a football hero.
Gosh.
Yes, my father's music.
You gotta be a football hero to get along with a beautiful girl. You gotta be a touchdown getter, you bet. If you wanna get a baby to pet, the fact that you are rich or handsome won't get you anything in curls. You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girls.
And he wrote, potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper, now the time to fall in love. He wrote that for Eddie Cantor.
Wow.
He wrote huge hits. He was a very, very successful writer from the 20s into the early 40s. He did the middle 40s. Yeah, he had big hits. And he was quite a wonderful man, too. And he taught me a lot about writing songs. And my brother Bob and I were teamed by my father to write songs together. And so all the while, I was working on serious pop songwriting and then writing into productions with Disney and all. I was having fun writing my Busman's Holiday. I was writing songs with Milt to laugh about because we were just writing them for the fun of it.
Sometimes that's the best way to do it, huh? You're having a great time with it, and it's not, there's no pressure involved. And
well, I think fortunate is the man or the woman who can do a thing he loves to do and make a living at it. But basically, you have to love it. And that's the whole thing. You have to dedicate yourself to it. I've loved songs all my life. I love good songs. I listen to some of the Berlin songs, the exquisite simplicity of his writing, and the very marvelous writing of Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein, and the great writing of Noel Coward, and the great writing of Cole Porter. And I'm in tears at how gorgeous it is, and how special it is, and how marvelous it is. And those are the people that inspired me, and I wanted to be in that world. I wanted to write that kind of thing. And so, yes, the great writers of the past were my inspiration, and my father was my inspiration, and he was the one that sort of guided me, and that this has been done, this has been done, you got to think of an original way of saying it, and everything. He was marvelous about that, because redundancy and corn is not my cup of tea. I like to try to find something that's fresh and different, and that's the whole thing.
Well, great for you. Great. What is, since you mentioned your father, I understand the way he got you two into writing songs, either professionally or whatever, is to, did he issue a challenge to both of you?
Yeah, he sure did. He one day, my brother wanted to write the Great American Novel, and I was going to write the Great American Musical all by myself. I was going to write it. And we were both succeeding and failing completely. Nothing was happening. We were just out of college and living in a tiny little apartment. And one day he came into our little apartment. He said, I bet you guys, with all your talent and your college degrees and everything, I bet you haven't got enough brains to write a pop song that some kid would give up his lunch money for. And he just said that and left. And we looked at each other and said, you know something? He threw the gauntlet down.
Do you think he knew what he was doing?
Yeah, he sure as hell did. He said, you guys couldn't do that. I bet you don't. You, with all your brains, you couldn't do that. And so we started listening to the pop music of the day, which was very country western. It was the early 50s. Uh-huh. And we were listening to all these wonderful, wonderful, simple songs that were being written by the country writers and by gifted pop songwriters who were writing that kind of music. And we listened very closely, and we started writing song after song, trying to come up with an idea. And finally, one day, and Dad would come and listen to our stuff, and he'd say, it's been done. This is very corny. I expect every line I'm hearing over here. He would very nicely, but insult us because we were learning. And you got to write a lot of bad before you write something good.
Right.
And then one day we were trying to come up with a twist. He said, you got to come up with something that's different. You got to arrest somebody's ear in the first two bars of the song. So we were writing a song called You Can't Buy Love. And we said, you can't buy love. Well, that's been done, you know. But gold can buy anything but love. Yeah, that's it. Gold can buy anything but love.
Uh-huh.
And we said, we got it. We'll call the song Gold Can Buy Anything. Right, you know. Wow, and it's a title that's just provocative. I mean, who the hell could, you can't buy love. You can't buy somebody's heart, what people feel. You can't do that. And so we had a provocative title. And because we had a provocative title, we had a good little song that went with it, because we were pretty talented guys, but we just had been writing crap. And all of a sudden, this was a clever idea. And my dad said, now you have a pop song. Take it into Vine Street. There's a lot of publishers there. And he gave us a couple of names and tipped off one publisher that he said, I think my boys have a good song. You should listen to this. So he came into this publisher's office and he said, yeah, I think I can do something with that. And he said, wow, you know, a publisher wants to publish our song. My God, you know. So we were very thrilled about that. And the next thing we know, he had landed Gene Autry to sing our song. We said, my God, this is unbelievable, because Gene Autry was the number one country western singer in the world at that time. This
was
1951.
Sure was. Yeah.
And he was incredible. So we were thrilled. We got a Columbia record with Gene Autry. And we were breaking for a smash hit. Truly, talk about smash flops. And what happened then was quite a story, because the war in Korea was getting very hot, and General MacArthur had crossed the 38th parallel. This has nothing to do with the popular music business,
sure.
But he had crossed the 38th parallel, and Truman decided to recall him because he had gone against Truman's wishes to do that. He said, I want you to cross the 38th parallel in Korea. So he was recalled, and a farewell speech was made by General MacArthur in front of Congress, and he concluded his speech with these propitious words. He said, well, I conclude my Army career with an old barracks ballad that we used to sing back at West Point. He said, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. Mm-hmm. And that's what he concluded his speech with. Gene Autry picked that up, recorded Old Soldiers Never Die, and overnight, our song was ripped off the presses, and the new song, Gene Autry's Old Soldiers Never Die, was on the presses and being distributed around the country. We were devastated. It was the end of, we felt it's the end of the world. And our dad said, that's what you call a curve in this business. And if you can't take a curve ball, you get out of the game. And he said, well, we're not going to get out of the game. And we didn't.
Good.
And we kept trying and working and working and trying. And slowly but surely, over many, many long and arduous years with little minor hits and minor flops, we sort of staggered across our lives trying and trying to make it happen. And then one day, a little kid named Annette Funicello was given a song of ours that we had written for another girl. And it was called Tall Paul.
Right.
He's my all.
He's my mountain. He's my tree. We go steady. Paul and me. Tall Paul.
Great big smile.
Tall Paul.
Great big eyes.
Tall Paul.
Great big kiss.
He's my all. Tall Paul. Tall Paul. Tall Paul. He's my all.
And Annette sang it, and it became a smash hit. Hit the top 10, and that started our career because she worked for Walt Disney, and Disney was listening to everything Annette was doing. And the nice people at Disneyland Records said, hey, could you write some more songs for Annette? She said, you betcha we can. We sure can. Oh, we betcha. And we started writing song after song for Annette and had a string of very successful albums and songs with her. And that led to our meeting Walt Disney, and Walt Disney dug what we were doing. He knew a lot about our songs because we had written so much for Annette. And so a couple of years after Tall Paul, we were asked to come to the studio and write a song for Annette for a film.
Yeah.
And Walt liked the film, liked the song, and then he gave us assignments, and we wrote a song for Haley Mills and three more songs for that picture. It was called The Parent Trap. And then he gave us some assignments to write for Zorro and some other things that he was producing. And he liked everything we wrote, which was amazing. And one day he handed us a book, and it had a red cover, and it was written by somebody named P.L. Travers, and it was called Mary Poppins. And he didn't say, write me a song about this. He said, read this book and tell me what you think. The rest is the story of my life.
Wow. That is fantastic. Boy, you crammed a lot in there. I certainly appreciate all that that insight. You know,
Everybody gets punched in the face constantly in this business. You don't just walk in and have hits. I don't know. I mean, unless you're maybe, even the Beatles had years of struggle before they started smashing it with hits.
Sure.
You got to have the courage to keep going. You got to have the faith in yourself. And you got to have the ability to stay in the business. In other words, Bob and I didn't just write songs in those days. I mean, I had a part-time job. He had a part-time job. Just enough to keep the roof over our heads and put a little food on the table. But basically, we were writing and writing and writing. That was the major occupation. Then someday, it gets lucky, and then all of a sudden, the sun is shining for you. But you have to have tenacity. I mean, if you don't have tenacity and you can't take rejection, don't be in this business, because it's all rejection. It's constantly. Nobody needs you. Nobody wants you. And you have to make them want you. It's very hard to do that.
Even I take that to heart. I mean, as songwriters or people that are trying to create, you want people to like all your everything that you create, and when it doesn't get the acclaim that you want, you get a little discouraged, right? So
yeah, and you can get very discouraged. It hurts. It's very you pour your heart into these things. Of course.
Did you ever have
when somebody doesn't appreciate it, or doesn't understand it, or insults you with it? it's not easy. No.
I'm assuming that the words of your father telling you, you know, that was a curve, and,
yes,
and you got to roll with that type of thing, that's probably stuck with you, and that helped you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very much so, because, well, you know, in those early days, it was one rejection after another. I mean, we didn't just have one hit on top of another. It was slow and slow. And finally, we, you know, we, the thrill of just having my name on a record was such a giant thing. And then eventually, and you got to live off those things. And then one day, you know, you're part of an album of some major singer, and wow, that's a giant feeling. And all these things were things that don't make as much money as they give you the confidence to keep going. I know when I got out of the service, I was in the Army in the 50s, uh-huh. And when I came out, my brother and I weren't working together, and I was on my own, and I wrote a little song with another fellow, and it was the hottest day in July, I remember that, and we said, let's write a wintry song. So we decided to write a song about Christmas in New Orleans, and we said, that's a great idea, because it's a hot place, and people celebrate Christmas there in their own way and everything. We wrote a little Dixieland song just because it was fun to write it, and it sounded good. And the next thing we know, Louis Armstrong, my hero, the greatest jazz singer in the world, recorded it. He loved the song, and now it's the official song of New Orleans. Joe Van Winkle and I wrote that song back in 1955.
So
and it was
great.
Just because it was a hot day, we said, let's write something different. And we wrote that. And it's something I'm very proud of, I mean, Christmas in New Orleans. It's one of my first standards that became a kind of a classic. Yeah, but it's played to this day. It's always been used in albums and played all the time.
Your kids will disappear when you hear Hallelujah, St. Nicholas is here. When it's Christmas time in New Orleans.
I'm playing the Yes Man to you because everything that you said, I agree with. This is all fantastic stuff that you created. You know, that Tall Paul. I remember all the things that you're talking about. So I gotta take a quick break. Can you hang on just a second?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And there you have it. That's part one. Wow. Richard Sherman, what do you think of him, huh? Isn't he great? You've got to come back and hear the second part of this interview. We just scratched the surface of, you know, how he got started with his brother Robert and the great Walt Disney. And we'll have a lot more of that next time and some more surprises. You just got to hear what's next. It's going to be super califret. Well, you get the idea. Anyway, a huge thank you to Richard Sherman for the use of his songs. I really appreciate that. And if you missed any of this interview, you can always go to strongwriter.com and you can hear the past episodes, including this one, parts one and two. I got to get going. Let us know on social media, Facebook, Strong Writer on the Radio. Let me know what you thought of the interview. I, for one, had a blast. So until next time, this is Dean Olson, the Strong Writer on the Radio, saying, let's all put our best pens forward and be strong writers together. Go forth and have a great weekend. Take care. Goodbye now.
You've been listening to Strong Writer on the Radio with your host, Dean Olson, on the amazing Women and Men of Power, world's leading positive programming network powered by Raven International.